Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was noting how the animals survive through the harsh Maine winter in her yard. We resume Suburban Safari on page 194, and this is episode 19. The woof-woof of seagull wings blows a cold wind of hypocrisy in my face. How is it that I can fret over the cold toes of the crows, then pound on the window when a seagull or a starling descends? The starlings, to speak in my own defense, travel in packs that can vacuum up pints of kibbles in 60 seconds, while the crows are still tiptoeing across the snow watching for alligators. And starlings are a European species that needs no help conquering the world. The gulls, well, they're just as greedy and 6 times bigger. The uncomfortable thing is that they're native birds, holding a valid passport to this neighborhood. Why not feed them? When I ponder this, I recall that I only started feeding the crows to lure them into the yard so I could watch their fascinating behavior. And seagulls aren't fascinating. I grew up with them and never saw one commit an interesting act. Even the one my sister raised from an egg impressed me only by how large an object he could swallow. So, with almost no guilt, I go on throwing rocks, garden clogs, and mittens at starlings and gulls. It's late January when I remember that the little peach tree is standing unprotected in the yard. Its tender bark is exposed to mice, who will tunnel to it and strip it. With its circulatory system girdled, the sapling will emerge from winter as a dry stick. I meant to wrap it before the snow flew, but I meant to do a lot of things before snow flew. I head out to trample the snow around the trunk. If the mice want the peachling, they'll have to come out on top of the snow and do their damage in broad starlight. In my trampling, I nick the trunk and am surprised to see electric green beneath the bark. But it goes to show, even those who hibernate through the frosty months don't shut down completely. Most organisms have to stay a little bit awake to stay alive. Many plants, like dandelions and milkweed, don't even attempt to survive. These annuals throw all their energy into seeds that will revive the family name in the spring. Then they fall down dead. But perennial plants, including my oak tree creaking in the wind, have to stand and confront the cold. Unlike animals, plants are sessile, nailed to the spot, which rules out hibernation and shelter building. Once again, my plants demonstrate more smarts than I would have given them credit for. Back in August, the oak tree and the pines noticed the days were getting short. A hormone that halts growth suffused their branches and leaves. Each cell, anticipating that ice crystals would form around it, hardened its linings to prevent puncture. The trees, and all the other overwintering plants in the yard, assembled freeze-resistant molecules to stir into their sap. Some replaced water with sugars. Some adjusted their proteins. Some added fats to their needles. Some mixed and matched strategies. However they did it, by the end of August, my trees were ready to fight a freeze. They rested and waited. Frost hit on October 9th. All around the trees, annual plants went rigid. Dew that settled on the tomato leaves froze. Then a crystal contagion spread inside the leaf tissue itself, gouging cells. When the morning sun struck the frosted leaves, the crystals thawed, the cells bled, and the leaves went limp. Standing tall amid the ruin, my trees got back to work. Through October, they laid in more antifreeze every day. The mercury drifted down, and my oak tree's twigs chilled along with the air. The day the twigs fell a few degrees below freezing, they got a quick fever. Is my oak tree warm-blooded? Given the ability of cold-blooded insects to warm themselves and warm-blooded mammals and birds to chill themselves, one could be forgiven for asking, but this heat burst is the signature of ice. Crystals have just formed in the spaces between the tree's cells, and that shift from liquid to solid released heat. It was a fleeting reprieve. The tree reaped a more lasting benefit from the ice itself, which pulled water from inside the cells. The cells were left holding a syrup of antifreeze. By the time the sun had resumed its winter habit of setting at noon behind the south neighbor's roof, the tree was nearly finished. Each leaf had shunted unused nutrients back into the branches. A layer of cells grew between leaf and limb, cutting off circulation. The green chlorophyll faded from dying leaves, and in mid-November a big wind knocked down all the dead leaves in one night. The sumacs had lost their leaves many weeks before, so had the apples. The lilacs and the chokecherry were bare. My little forest was gray and prepared, except for the pines. It's hard to gauge the preparedness of a pine, because it hangs on to its needles. It seems like a costly thing to do. Each leaf can leak moisture to the dry winter air, dehydrating the tree. And each leaf has to be saturated with antifreeze. So why not chuck 'em like deciduous trees? Again, I turn to Peter Marchand's Life in the Cold. The leaky needles hazard, Marchand contends, is a bit overblown. Evergreens seal their leaves with a high-performance wax that works especially well in the cold. And evergreen stomates, the little air ports on the underside of a leaf, can seal much tighter than deciduous stomates. I'm surprised to learn that the worst hazard winter can present to my pine trees is a sunny day. Then water vapor trapped in the dark needles heats up and wants to escape into the cold air. Because of this, my pines will dry out a bit as the winter progresses. Even so, one of Marchand's own experiments demonstrates that if you snip the trunk of a spruce tree under the snow, the tree can stay hydrated right through winter. Only when spring temperatures heat the truncated tree will it be forced to exhale fatal quantities of moisture. So despite their need to winterize every needle, the pines know what they're doing. They're going to save a bundle of energy next spring by reusing last year's leaves. And on the day the sun climbs over the neighbor's roof once more, the pines will be ready to collect it and grow. They may be back in the light harvesting business as early as February. In a natural forest, pines and oaks compete for sunlight, with the prize going to the tree who grabs enough of it to grow tall and shade out the competition. If the pines have evolved a way to collect light earlier in the year, the oaks had better do likewise. That could explain why the stem of the little peach tree was green under the bark. Peaches, oaks, and other deciduous trees keep chlorophyll in their bark through the winter. When the pine needles start hauling in the sunbeams in February, my oaks may begin gathering it too, with their leafless twigs. Dead as my forest looks now, even buried branches may be churning out a few carbohydrates by photosynthesizing light particles that penetrate the snow. As the snow ages and turns icy, still more light will penetrate, waking the buried plants. My trees may even be drawing a small drink of water out of the frozen yard. Experiments show that water does rise slowly through the woody trunks of various trees and shrubs in midwinter, even when the plumbing under their bark is frozen. Where they find this beverage is problematic. Peter Marchand speculates that even in frozen ground, thin films of liquid water may coat some soil particles. Beneath my boots, beneath the soil, the roots of all the perennials are whistling in the dark. They're not dead, and they're not frozen. The oak roots and the bamboo roots, the tulip bulbs and the iris tubers, all weatherproofed themselves in the darkening days of fall. They cast off their green uppers and withdrew under the protection of the soil. The earth turned rigid around them, but the antifreeze in their cells buffered them from the cold. Like the woodchuck, they wait. I take shelter from the wind in the lee of the far apple tree. Even at high noon these days, the sun doesn't get halfway to overhead, but it does deliver a little heat. The tree's dark trunk is absorbing some of those rays. I poke around the flakes of bark, looking for insects who might be thawing. My mittens are too bulky to explore with any grace, and it's too cold to take them off, but I know the insects are here. Only one, the monarch butterfly, is truly migratory, so the rest must be here. They must be everywhere. Stiff larvae, shiny pupae, clusters of eggs, even adult animals, are stashed under bark, under stones and fallen leaves, and scattered through the earth between the shelters of mice and woodchucks. Insects lack the insulation that birds and mammals rely on. Naked and tiny, they stare down snowflakes larger than themselves. Many take the approach that annual plants do. They lay indestructible eggs while it's still warm, then give up the ghost. But those who brave the winter undergo transformations that belie the insect's reputation for simplicity. Of all the overwintering geniuses, the goldenrod gall fly is extra talented. This walnut-colored fruit fly lays an egg on a shoot of goldenrod, a tall annual plant with an August spray of mustard-colored flowers. The gall fly's worm gnaws into the shoot, and in a flourish of genetic engineering, causes the plant to grow a 1-inch bead of flesh on its stem. Inside the gall, the larva eats goldenrod tissue, molting twice as she grows. But in her third instar, incarnation roughly translated, she senses a chill in the air. She modifies her own innards now. As the days shorten, the larva's body manufactures granules of calcium phosphate, the stuff bones are made of. She also brews a slew of sugars and alcohols that lower the freezing point of her body fluid. The mercury ticks downward while she eats on until the cold halts her chewers. One night, frost on the goldenrod stem inoculates the plant cells with ice and the plant dies. On the brown stalk, inside the gall, the larva lies motionless. The following weeks, shove the temperature in the gall down to 30 degrees. The larva remains soft. At 20 degrees, she's still soft. At 15 degrees, soft. She's supercooled, below freezing, but still liquid. Most insects can do no more than this to fend off ice. They don't want to freeze, and so they perfect their supercooling. For instance, the flesh fly, that's the dog-dew-eating, carrion-colonizing look-alike of the house fly, can stay crystal-free to 10 below zero. Supercoolers usually rely on protections beyond their antifreeze. They build cocoons or find sheltered spots, either under a few inches of soil, under bark, or in the eaves of my house. And whereas the goldenrod gallfly manufactures little particles in her body, serious supercoolers purge themselves of anything that might give ice a foothold. They empty their gut to be sure no bacteria or fungi remain for supercooled liquid to freeze upon. They cleanse their blood of food particles that could give ice a grip. Heaven forbid someone should drop a snowflake on a supercooled insect. It takes very little to cause a storm of crystallization in such cold fluid, but as long as a supercooled critter doesn't ingest, inhale, or bump against a particle that could set off a chain reaction, he'll be fine. Down to a point. For a yellow jacket wasp, the point at which supercooling fails and crystallization kills is 19 degrees. The record for superest cool is held by a beetle of the Canadian Arctic, 78 below zero. The goldenrod gallfly, however, is protected even from catastrophic crystallization. Way back up the thermometer, the larva saw a super cold day coming. Instead of purging her particles, she deployed them into her body fluid. The circulating calcium phosphate specks invited her liquids to freeze, and they extended the offer so early that the crystallization was gradual, not cataclysmic. In the spaces between her cells, the fluids solidified. Water inside the cells seeped out to join the growing crystals. Antifreeze, left in the cells, strengthened her cell membranes to prevent collapse. Her cells, now holding syrup, will not freeze. Well, not unless the mercury hits 40 or 50 below zero. Then her goose will be cooked. If it's a quick hit of cold, perhaps she'll only be injured. Flesh fly pupae that get too cold may live through the freeze, only to be stuck in their cases. If they can emerge, nerve damage may prevent them from eating or grooming themselves. They may not be able to reproduce. They may wish they hadn't survived. And a deeper freeze is, of course, completely lethal. Insects employ their antifreeze strategies at all stages of development. Eggs, larvae, pupae, adults. Whichever phase faces the winter, battens the hatches and hunkers down. And while insects' abilities are remarkable, they're not foolproof. A cold winter, especially if there's no insulating snow, plunges icicles into the hearts of a huge percentage of insects and their eggs. Even a soft winter can be hard for some. The goldenrod gallfly will burn too much energy if the cold doesn't put a halt to her metabolism, and then she'll likely die. She may die even in perfectly cold weather because chickadees and woodpeckers have learned to recognize those brown bulbs on goldenrod stems. Like children cracking walnuts, the birds breach the pithy walls and swallow the carefully cooled meat. Today, I can detect no insect motion in the yard. But under the snow, I know some exceptional animals are working straight through the winter. Investigators, with more foresight than I have, sunk pitfall traps into the earth before it froze and have been rewarded for their effort. From beneath the snow on a frozen lawn, they interrupted the winter work of ants, springtails, mites, and nematodes. January delivers its 13 cold days, and then some. February will prove just as hoary. This winter will win awards for the length and depth of its coldness. It'll shape up to be an excellent winter for stabbing insects. The spring will deliver a smaller crop of ticks, mosquitoes, and termites. But there will also be fewer butterflies, ants, and robber flies. And my birds, with hungry families to feed, will notice the difference. At this time of year, the North Pole leans away from the sun. During the day, the sun's rays strike people at my latitude in the ribs. The top of our heads go unlit. The sun sets shortly after 4 in the afternoon, and at midnight tonight, the trees in my yard will be pointing almost straight away from the sun. That's how far the planet tilts. We plants and animals of the northern latitudes spend long winter nights facing the darkness of space. Tonight, when Indonesia is being broiled, the occasional photon will scatter around the globe to zing through our sky. But photons will be few and far between. Winter up here on the shoulder of the planet is just plain dark. It's cold. It lasts a long time, and we who stay in our home latitude are hard-pressed to get through it without taking a bite out of a huddle mate. Even Dave Santoro, who I thought could never be persuaded to speak ill of the weather, is running out of patience with the cold. He says, "Who landed in Jamestown and said, 'No, no, no, this isn't cold enough. I'm going a few hundred miles north where the winters are longer.'" He throws up his hands and lets them fall. Outside my window, the trees stand motionless in the dark, their heads like dull arrows, pointing toward another long night. Chapter 11. Melting Pot Blues. The leftovers of my sharp-shinned hawk's lunch lie at the center of a circle of feathers. The lunch's breastbone is blue-white, bitten ragged by the sharpie's bill. Maroon flesh clings to it. The ribs are intact, but the gut is gone. The gizzard dangles at the end of the esophagus. The heart glistens in the chest cavity. The thigh meat has been stripped away, and the skin of the back is missing. Bits of yellow fat remain where the breast meat was. The wings spread wide, and the feathers are iridescent green. The head is thrown back in the oak leaves, too, exposing a black velvet throat and a yellow bill. Half an hour ago, when I saw the hawk wrestle its meal to the ground, I couldn't tell who that meal was. Now I can see it's a starling. Couldn't have happened to a better bird. As a botanist friend told me this summer, my yard typifies a problem that's global in scale. Foreign plants and animals gain a foothold on the shore, then drive the natives into the deepest woods and harshest deserts. In my yard, the conquest is nearly complete. Among the plants, outsiders outnumber natives 4-1. For mammals, it's a closer contest with foreign rats and cats facing off against native raccoons, skunks, possums, mice, and shrews. As for the birds, I'd have to say that the foreigners are winning. The forsythia hedge is lousy with English sparrows. Pigeons descend in a mob that scatters the local juncos and cardinals like leaves. Starlings are so numerous that they swoop over the yard in throbbing clouds. Well, they're one starling less numerous today. How do they get to this continent, these not-so-huddled masses? The starling is unusual. He was brought intentionally, lovingly. Most invaders come by accident. The Norway rat, stowed away in the holds of ships. The earthworms who are altering northeastern forests probably came in potting soil, ballast dirt, or along with dirty livestock. More recently, the Asian long-horned beetle entered undetected in lumber from China. But the starling was introduced on purpose. In 1890, human immigrants in New York City imported and freed 60 of the birds in Central Park. The members of the American Acclimatization Society had taken the notion that they themselves would acclimatize better to their new homeland if every bird mentioned in the plays of Shakespeare was here. Many of the transported starlings perished. The survivors founded a population that today sweeps from coast to coast. Northern Canada is too cold for them, limiting their conquest of that realm. The result has been less poetic than its inspiration. Starlings destroy crops. Their noisy herds cause other birds to flee. In breeding season, they wrest nesting cavities from woodpeckers, including the rare red-headed woodpecker. And when starlings congregate in roosts, their droppings become a breeding ground for fungi that cause blastomycosis and histoplasmosis in people. Ecologists used to think that an invading species required an open niche in the ecosystem. Starlings demonstrated that a good invader creates its own luck by taking someone else's niche. In my yard, starlings not only monopolize the best tree holes, they even steal food from the crows. When I toss out kibbles, a flock of starlings often touches down like a tornado, snatching up the food while the crows are still double-checking the lawn for hidden perils. Maddening as starlings are, if I were given a vote about whom the hawks should kill in my yard, I'd request that they eat the English sparrows first. Starlings may quash the woodpecker population by denying them places to reproduce, but at least they don't kill other birds outright. The English sparrow is a murderer. He pecks the head off other birds, and through West Nile virus may even be picking off people. In my yard, the English sparrows monopolize the best winter habitat, the dense forsythia hedge. When they're not squabbling amongst themselves, they issue a loud, monotonous, cheet, cheet, cheet. They're not even nice to look at. The males have a gray cap, a chestnut back, white cheeks, and a black bib. The females are dull beyond description. The beak is thick, confirming that this sparrow is actually a finch. I'm giving up on scattering regular birdseed because of them. They flock to it, then bully any hungry natives who dare to come forward. Juncos are driven off, as are white crowns. Cardinals, being twice as big as a sparrow, are slower to retreat, but the sparrows are persistent. Back in berry season, I watched the sparrows target a cardinal who was sitting on the fence near the raspberry canes. A handful of sparrows flew to sit on either side of the cardinal. They jiggled and jostled, harassing the cardinal with bodily proximity. They hopped over the cardinal to sit on his other side. They yapped and cheeped. Finally, the cardinal gave up, flying away from the food. Another day, I watched the sparrows hassle a downy woodpecker, following her from one apple tree to the next, surrounding her and yelling wherever she tried to feed. She could ignore them for a few minutes, then she'd wing away for a break. Each time she returned, they mobbed her anew. I grow to hate them. I dream of mist-netting them and twisting their little necks, slinging them into the bamboo wilderness for the skunks. I'm relieved to learn that I'm not alone. I had heard gossip about English sparrows killing bluebirds. When I went looking for confirmation, I located my fellow sparrow haters. Their trapping inventions and killing techniques are easily located on the web. The sites are illustrated with candid camera shots of sparrows pecking other birds' eggs and of baby bluebirds tossed from the nest to die on the ground. I can imagine the rage this inspires in the breast of a bluebird lover. Eastern bluebird numbers have plummeted as sprawl and farms consume their habitat. Aiding their survival is an impassioned network of people who erect nest boxes for them. Starlings can be excluded by limiting the size of the doorway, but English sparrows can squeeze through a smaller hole. And even if an English sparrow doesn't want a bluebird's box for his own brood, he may still enter and kill the bluebird, on principle. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn, by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.